I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
President John F. Kennedy spoke those words in 1961 before a joint session of Congress, declaring the dramatic and ambitious goal of sending an American safely to the moon before the end of that decade. The pressure was on. A month earlier, a Russian cosmonaut had become the first human to orbit the Earth. Now, the pressure is off. What's changed? What worked? What didn't? Today, we'll talk about the launch of the space shuttle Atlantis last Friday and the future of U.S. space travel and exploration. Joining us today is Michael Stamatikos. He is a postdoctoral fellow with OSU Center for Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics and also an astrophysicist with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Also joining us is Jay Barbary. He's a correspondent for NBC and MSNBC News. Jay also is the only journalist to have covered every manned space mission in the U.S., beginning with the first American in space and the launch last week of the space shuttle Atlantis. He has written or co-written 7 books, including Moonshot, the inside story of America's Apollo moon landing with Alan Shepard and Deke Slayton. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Hey, thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me.
And for our listeners, do you think taxpayers should continue to fund NASA and space exploration? Would you want to be a colonist to the planet Mars? We're going to get to Mars later on. Let us know. Would you like to be a colonist to the planet Mars? And what do you think about taxpayer-funded space exploration? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and question or comment there. Jay, you've been present for all of America's 100 and I have 66 manned space launches written.
That's
here.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Every manned launch, yeah. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and 135 space shuttle launches. And when I saw that, that sort of shocked me that there were that many launches. And after a while it became sort of humdrum, but the program goes back before President Kennedy, when you scooped the news that President Dwight D. Eisenhower would use a satellite to broadcast a pre-recorded Christmas message from outer space.
That was December 1958, Ann, yes.
And so what was it back? We just mentioned 135 space shuttle launches, ho-hum, after a while. But back then, remind us, what was it like?
Oh, well, everything was news back then. Any missile launch, when Sputnik went up, the country just could not believe it. That was October the 4th, 1957. I was working for Channel 10 in Albany, Georgia. Got in a big fight trying to shoot a Ku Klux Klan rally up there, and got in a big fight with the Ku Klux Klan, and they suggested that I relocate. So I relocated to Cape Canaveral, Florida, being very interested in the space industry. And after being down here about 6 months, I got on with NBC, and I'm completing my 53rd year with NBC this month on July the 21st.
Congratulations.
But anyway... what it was like was everything in those days was news about space. If we just launched a missile successfully, that was news because more were blowing up than they were going up. And that's why when Alan Shepard and John Glenn were the first to go into space, we were so proud of these people and such heroes as they are. And John is your own Ohio guy, mm-hmm. Senator for many years. And anyway, for them to get on these rockets that blew up more often than they flew, it was quite a task. But everybody was interested in that, and it continued with the race to the moon because it was a race for prestige, if you will. And then after we had successfully, easy for me to say, get to the moon, as we did with 12 men on it, and then we went into shuttle. And people do not really realize what shuttle accomplished here today. It did not accomplish some things it set out to do, but we enjoy science today that we wouldn't have had, I'm told by other scientists, that we would not have had for 50 years. And people don't realize that everything they do today in medicine, the good care that we have with the different images in medicine with GPS, my good friend Dr. Gene McCall, a Princeton physicist, worked on all of this. And what we can do and are doing in space today and the things that we have in communications and in cell phones and in computers, because a little laptop computer today has actually more computation capacity than the computers that took Neil Armstrong to the moon for the first time. So they just don't realize what has been accomplished with this, and it would be very difficult if it doesn't continue. And right now we're at a crossroads, and NASA is trying to bring on commercial companies, but at the same time, we're on a planet that's 8,000 miles in diameter. It has a human support system that's only 10,000 feet deep, and it's infinite. It will not last forever. We're going to have to get off, and if we don't continue, the age of the human species is no more than 200,000 years now, and we're going to have to get off of this planet one day. And if we don't continue to explore, which is what humans do, then the human species is over with. But I'll get off my soapbox.
Okay. My guest is Jay Barbary. He's a correspondent for 53 years coming up for NBC and MSNBC News. He's also the only journalist to have covered every manned space mission in the U.S. If you have a question or comment for Jay, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And also tell us if you think the space exploration should be publicly funded, and what you think about travel to Mars. You've said that reporters and astronauts, Jay, often socialized in the early days of the space program, and you became a friend and confidant with several of them. You mentioned you're going to be seeing John Glenn next week. And tell us about that relationship, because it certainly doesn't exist anymore.
Let me tell you this, Ann. Mm-hmm. This is a little self-serving. But I did the book Moonshot with Alan Shepard.
Right.
And that came out with Alan Shepard and Deke Slayton. It's introduced by Ohio's own Neil Armstrong. And it came out and went to number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list back in 1994. Well, the families got back in touch with me, and we decided to update Moonshot. And we did update it for the 50th anniversary of Alan Shepard's first flight. And it's out. It went to number 28 in Barnes & Noble this week. But it's out now primarily as an e-book, electronic book, but you can still get it in print. Mm-hmm. It has all of the launches in there, videos, as you e-book readers you're going through, you're going to see. So I only want to say, even though this is self-serving, I'm doing this for Alan Shepard's grandkids, Deke Slayton's grandkids, Neil Armstrong's grandkids. We even have John Glenn introducing this. But the real story that you're asking me about right now is in Moonshot. All of the relationships, the stories, and everything. You know, I'll tell you one quick one on your friend John Glenn. And we both know him. He's a wonderful person. After he'd flown into orbit, he was making a speech one night, and when they introduced him as one of the real heroes of America, in which we do not have heroes like that anymore. And on the way home in the car, he's talking to his wonderful wife, Annie. And he's saying, Annie, you know, maybe what the man was saying was, maybe we don't have as many heroes as we used to have. And maybe we do need a few more, or blah, blah, blah. And Annie looked at him and said, John, there's one less than you think.
she's great.
So anyway,
like that, isn't she?
Those stories and
well, let me ask you this about the hero thing, because in 1986 and again in 2003, some amazing, brilliant, creative people died suddenly, and there still was a lot of danger, and there still is a lot of danger, of course. Atlantis is up there. In space travel, but we don't see astronauts, or we don't tend to regard them the same way as we used to. Just culturally, how has that changed over time? It became more the technology than the people.
Because there was like 356, I think is the correct number, close to that flew on the shuttle spacecraft. Now, there was 800 and something trips up there by astronauts, but many of them flew 4 and 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
But out of where you started out with 7, all of a sudden you've got 350 astronauts, and it's very difficult to keep up with them. But again, on the other hand, when we lost these 14 lives in the 2 accidents of Challenger and Columbia, Anne, when that took place, people began to know them okay, and they knew all about them, but it's hard to stay in touch with that many people flying. Now, you were mentioning a while ago, where are we going from here?
Mm-hmm.
NASA's at a crossroads now. It has released contracts to get private companies to develop spacecraft. And I've talked to these people who are building these spacecraft, and I've asked them questions. Whose astronauts will they be? Who will be mission control be involved? How involved is NASA? Well, they don't have any answers to these questions yet. They're still trying to develop. And well, John Glenn, myself, Neil Armstrong, all of the guys that flew in the early days are very worried about this. When John Glenn was on Nightly News, Brian Williams' Nightly News with me last Monday night, and talking precisely about the fact that we retired shuttle before we had another spacecraft to go to. Now, it's true that President George Bush canceled a shuttle after the Columbia accident in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
He canceled it, but Constellation was supposed to be ready or near ready, and Congress was dragging its feet on funding Constellation, and the Obama administration canceled it. And here we're sitting ready to land, probably will be next Thursday or Thursday week on the 21st, land the shuttle Atlantis, and that'll be it. We have spent $750 million. Let me repeat that. NASA has contracted $750 million to the Russian Space Agency to fly our astronauts to and from the space station until we get another spacecraft. And if there's delays, it's going to be even more. John Glenn pointed out that we could have used this $1 billion to keep a shuttle going. And we should have kept shuttle going until we have another spacecraft. But that's over with. It's not going to happen.
Right.
And so what they're trying to do is get them to make an announcement now on heavy lift. What that means is a bigger rocket about the size of the shuttle that will take astronauts finally out of orbit. You know, American astronauts or no Russian astronauts, no humans have been out of low Earth orbit since 1972 when Apollo 17 went to the moon and Gene Cernan stepped there for the last time. So these are the things that they're talking about now that they want to get going, and we need these people to get going. Our own senior senator, Bill Nelson, told me on the air the other day, he says, Jay, we're going to get this going in 10 days. He says, I'm going to call hearings. Everybody's for it. The president signed off on it. Both houses of Congress have signed off on it. Everybody signed off on it. And people think they're saving money. Well, let me tell you something. NASA's budget today is bigger than it's ever been. It's $18 billion. So we don't need that to continue space exploration of humankind. What we need is to spend part of that money on it and not spend so much money and NASA's money on everything that comes along, every little project here and there and all, and you've got constant fights going on between the scientists and between the engineers and between the manned people and against the venturers. And so here's where we are. We're not spending less money on NASA. We're just spending it in different places. And so anyway, if we're going to continue human exploration, and Charles Bolden, who is the NASA administrator now, a seasoned veteran space shuttle pilot himself, says on his watch, human spaceflight is not going to end. And I take Charlie at his word. He's a good man.
In the 1980s, you were a finalist for the Journalist in Space program, but the Challenger disaster ended that program. Let's listen.
65 seconds into flight, NASA Control orders Commander Scobie to go to full power.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
Suddenly, an explosion.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
I think most of us remember where we were when we saw that. I was at the newsroom at the Grand Rapids Press. You know, it's just something you never forget. But it did end the program for the Journalist in Space, and it maybe was the beginning of the end, although it seems after the 2003 explosion upon reentry that there just seemed to be the wind was taken away from the sails, that people just weren't that interested anymore.
That's true, Anne. And I know after that, it went on for about a year, and they finally decided not to fly a civilian again until the backup to Krista McAuliffe, the teacher that was on board that flight.
Mm-hmm.
She was to fly first. And John Glenn decided to try to go back into space again, and he did it in 1998 and on the shuttle. And so at the time, NASA made the decision to make Barbara Morgan an astronaut herself so that she could fly, and John Glenn technically became the first civilian to travel in space since Krista McAuliffe. And so anyway, there's really been no appetite for journalists to go up there, because during that time, Japanese journalists and others traveled into space on board Russia's Soyuz spacecraft. So the program was over at that time, and there's really not that much need. What we need now is to continue to explore space, explore it with astronauts, go to deep space, to asteroids, because what people talk about going to Mars, they forget one simple thing. We don't know how to go to Mars. There's too much out there. You see, what's happening on the International Space Station, and will for another 20 years, we are learning how to live in space, and they're doing a pretty good job of it. But they have one big advantage, being 200 to 300 miles above the Earth. They're in the protection of the Earth's magnetosphere, protecting them from solar radiation. Once you leave the magnetosphere, then you're out on the moon. If you're living on the moon in colonies, you're living under the threat of solar radiation. You're deep space flight, you're under the threat of solar radiation. So that's one of the big problems that we have to solve. They're looking at a lot of things right now and a lot of ways of going. But Earth is only our cradle. As I mentioned before, it's a spacecraft 8,000 miles in diameter. Humans have a choice. We can live in the cradle forever until the cradle no longer will support us and we all die, or we can move on and explore what's out here in this great universe and first in our solar system.
Jay Barbary, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Ann. Anytime.
Jay Barbary, he's a correspondent for NBC and MSNBC News and the only journalist to have covered every manned space mission in the United States. Coming up, we'll meet with former U.S. Senator, scientist, astronaut Harrison Schmitt. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
A deal on the debt ceiling will involve compromise, which could mean cuts to Social Security and hikes to taxes. President Obama.
There's going to be pain involved politically on all sides.
I'm Neil Conan, the bottom line on the debt ceiling, plus the opinion page. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 here on 89.7 NPR News. And stay with our station beginning at 11 o'clock this morning for special coverage. President Obama is holding a news conference on the status of efforts to find a balanced approach to deficit reduction. And we will carry live coverage of that news conference beginning at 11.
Support for 89.7 comes from Global Gallery, a nonprofit featuring fair trade coffee and handcrafts from around the world in the Short North and in Clintonville Commons on North High Street. Information at ggfairtrade.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the future of U.S. space exploration in the wake of last Friday's final launch of the Space Shuttle program. With us is Michael Stamatikos. He is a fellow with OSU Center for Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics and an astrophysicist with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Welcome again, Mike, to you. And joining us now is the Honorable Harrison Schmitt of New Mexico. He is a geologist, pilot, astronaut, administrator, businessman, and writer, and served one term as U.S. Senator from New Mexico. Senator Schmitt was NASA's first scientist astronaut on Apollo 17 and one of only 12 people to have ever walked on the moon. And he's author of the book, Return to the Moon. Welcome to the show, Senator.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You were the lunar module pilot for Apollo 17 in 1972. It was the 11th and final manned moon landing in the American Apollo space program. You were the last of 12 humans to walk on the moon. Did you know then that you would be the last?
Yes, of course. Those unfortunate decisions to phase out the Apollo program really started in the Johnson administration and confirmed by the Nixon administration when they limited the purchase of Saturn V launch vehicles. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And that happened in 68, 69. We were going to have an end to the Apollo program, as we've now seen with the shuttle program. But it probably was much more, even more unfortunate than the end of the shuttle program.
Why is that?
Because we gave up the capability to explore deep space when we ran out of Saturn V, or at least canceled the last three missions.
You were the first scientist astronaut, and I was surprised to read that, not be, you know, ultimately surprised, but the sort of thing that astronauts do seems like science, and that every one of them is a scientist, but you're the first labeled a scientist astronaut. Why was that, and what was your background that prepared you?
Well, I was a professional geologist before I became a professional pilot for NASA. And all the other astronauts became reasonably well scientifically trained, but they did not have the background and experience that a professional career scientist would have. I was responsible for much of that scientific training for the Apollo astronauts, those that walked on the moon, and we made them into pretty good observers and excellent explorationists. But still, they did not have that many years of experience in making scientific decisions. Just as I did not have the many years of experience in making test pilot decisions.
Mike Stamatikos, what's the distinction when it comes to doing science in space? What does it mean?
Science in space, in the case of the senator's experience, was paramount, going to the moon as a geologist. I think that would be something that really highlights the need for human exploration in the terms of sending astronauts. I believe all exploration is human, whether it's astronauts or whether it's our robotic surrogates. In the case, one is better than the other for science return. Typically for geological investigations, I believe that it's better to send humans if possible. But there is synergies. For example, the Hubble Space Telescope is a beautiful example of the synergy, both in the deployment and also in the repair of fixing Hubble. And the ISS, which has to be the legacy of the 30-year mission of the shuttle, is opening us to a brand new decade of a national laboratory that's the most unique one we've ever built. So actually doing these experiments in unique environments, whether it be the lunar surface or whether it be in microgravity, is something that we should continue.
What you want to do is have people in space who, for particular kinds of tasks, have the confidence to make decisions based on their experience. And that's why you take professionals, whether it's test pilots or scientists or some other physicians or the like. You need that confidence. It comes only with experience. You can't teach that. You have to get it with experience.
Right. I mean, as the missions became more complex, the responsibility of the astronauts seemed to become even greater, even though their cultural acclaim or their popularity with the masses seemed to wane.
Well, I don't think that that's actually correct. If you do objective surveys throughout the many decades of the space era, you'll find that this public support for spaceflight has remained very high and gets higher, unfortunately, in a way, gets higher after an accident. And I think there's a good reason for that. The media begins to cover it again. The people do not normally get much information about spaceflight. They really don't. Still, in spite of that, you'll find generally 50 or 60% of the American people strongly support the continuation of the United States space activities. They just don't get much information unless it's the end of a program like we're seeing now, mm-hmm. or there's been some kind of an accident.
So there's a variety of discussions going on and have been for many years, as you mentioned, Senator, that it goes back to the Johnson administration when they started to defund the programs that put man on the moon. But there's still people like you. You've written in your book, Return to the Moon, that advocate a private investor-based approach to returning humans to the moon. But there's other different – then there's others that say it's deep space should be next. Mike, can you kind of summarize what are all the different scenarios out there that people envision?
Well, the basic outcome now, the basic story is we want to, for the first time since 1972, leave low Earth orbit. And the entire career of the space shuttle has been basically orbiting the Earth and deploying satellites, whether they be for communications and scientific purposes or actually building the International Space Station. So this push now to move beyond low Earth orbit comes with a question mark of where do you go? So in the era of Apollo and Kennedy, the answer was clear. It was to the moon. And there are various advocates for destinations, whether it be Mars, returning to the moon, or going to near-Earth objects like asteroids. Mm-hmm. So this is the so-called flexible path that we're on. The overarching theme is we want to leave low Earth orbit to private commercial endeavors that will now transfer cargo and crew eventually to International Space Station, utilize the unique scientific laboratory of ISS, but take NASA's effort going back into deep space, either returning to the moon for lunar base or preparation for future Mars trip, or going to an asteroid and getting science from that and avoiding what happened to the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Senator Schmidt?
Well, let me comment on that.
Sure.
We're not going to avoid going to what happened to the dinosaurs by going to one asteroid. That capability comes with having heavy lift launch vehicles like the Saturn V, and we had that capability to divert asteroids briefly for about 4 years in the Apollo era. What is, I think, critical right now is the geopolitical aspect of all of this, which the Obama administration seems to have forgotten, and that is that the United States is rapidly no longer becoming the dominant spacefaring nation, and that mantle is shifting to China. And it is extremely important for the future of freedom on this planet, as well as in space, I think, to have the United States, the only major protector of freedom on this planet, as the dominant spacefaring nation. And I do not see that attitude present in the current administration. Also, for that geopolitical emphasis, deep space, Mike is absolutely correct. Deep space is where it's going to be at, but you need a focus. And so I have proposed recently that we really dismantle NASA. NASA has had a great 50-year run. They've done some very remarkable things. But we need to focus young people now, again, as we did with Apollo, on deep space exploration. And the very logical place to continue to explore is the moon, because there you develop the capabilities to do other things.
My guests, former U.S. Senator Harrison Schmidt from New Mexico, all scientist, astronaut, author, and also Michael Stamatikos, postdoctoral researcher at OSU, where he's a astrophysicist. 614-292-8513, that's the number to call. If you have a question or comment, and tell us what you think. Should the public be funding the future space exploration for the United States or not? And would you like to colonize the moon? An email from Debbie, she says, I have loved everything about the space program my entire life. Is there a source of information that lists everything accomplished by the space program? I'm always telling people there is so much of our everyday life improved by technology from NASA. I would like a website to refer them to. Well, what do you think, Mike?
NASA.gov would be a good start. But there's a lot of spinoffs, not just Tang and Velcro. I mean, everything from appliances to smoke detectors to cordless instruments. And even the technology for breast cancer screening owes to the high-sensitive CCD cameras on the Hubble, for example. So there's lots of spinoffs and benefits to society from space exploration.
And Senator Schmidt, if we don't continue the level of funding, or if somehow we pull back from this these programs that we've had for the last 50 years, is there a way to measure what the impact might be over time as far as what we lose? Not just in the geopolitical sense, but just in technology and that sort of thing?
Well, it's very difficult to put quantitative numbers on that kind of a of a question answer. You have to base your answer, I think, on historical experience. And in every time the United States has explored, has emphasized exploration from its origins onto the present, there has been great benefit to society, as Mike has briefly outlined. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, of what has happened, the development of computers, of medical technology and the like. All had their impetus in the space program of the 1960s and 70s. But now the private sector has moved forward beyond that, and there's a tendency for us to look at private sector technologies to space qualify them and use them then as a continued advancement. But that doesn't mean that exploration is going to cease to provide great benefits to society, as we've seen in the American experience.
You know, they're talking about it at the university level, about how universities, particularly, you know, one as large as Ohio State University, can profit in a sense from its work in research and that sort of a thing. It's not part of the culture. Did NASA, did the U.S. space program profit enough from all of the things that it discovered over the years? Is there a way to do that?
NASA should not really be the profit center. It's the private sector and the American people that have benefited from these technology discoveries. And also, I think it's very important to recognize that young people have benefited. The Apollo program was a young person's program. The average age in the Johnson Space Center engineers and flight controllers during Apollo was in the 20s. Today, NASA's average age is in the 40s or close to 50. And that's one reason why I think we need to refocus with a new agency centered on deep space exploration, say a National Space Exploration Administration, so that we can again hire young people to do this job. It is very, very important. And when you do that, then you stimulate the education system, such as Ohio State, and the young people in that system to focus on careers that really have a great benefit to the national security and to the national economy.
From Paul on Facebook, he writes, I was born in 1969 and so missed the hoopla over the moon landing. In these frightening economic times, these Cold War space dinosaurs are an embarrassment. Let them play video games and let's put NASA's budget toward something of use.
Well, NASA's budget is minuscule compared to the outlandish spending that has taken place over the last 2 or 3 years. There is no question that the fundamental problem facing the United States today is that deficit, is the long-term legacy that we are giving to our children and grandchildren. But if it's at the same time we neglect the importance of defending freedom here on this planet as well as in space, then it won't make much difference how we solve that other problem.
My guests, Michael Stamatikos from OSU and also former U.S. Senator Harrison Schmitt. We're talking about the future of the United States space program. What will it look like in the future? 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. Talk about that. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we come back, we will hear from Robert Zubrin. He's the founder and president of the Mars Society. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.